Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Since 2006, American Craft Beer Week has been celebrated across the country during the month of May. So this week, we're joining in the celebration. We're lucky enough to have snagged one of America's all-time greats in craft beer, Steve Hindy of Brooklyn Brewery, for a conversation about the history of the craft beer movement and where it's going next. Louisiana microbreweries are rapidly spreading from one end of our state to the other. We'll visit with William McGee of Tin Roof Brewery in Baton Rouge and also learn how NOLA Brewing Company is combining beer and music for an amazing bit of philanthropy. And to top it all off, we turn to Polly Watts at the Avenue Pub for her predictions about craft brewing in Louisiana. Let's all kick back and have a cold one on this week's Louisiana Eats. Steve Hindy is one of the visionaries of American craft beer. Along with Tom Potter, Steve co-founded Brooklyn Brewery 26 years ago. Today, you can enjoy Brooklyn Brewery beer in 25 countries and 26 states, including Louisiana. In Steve's new book, The Craft Beer Revolution, Hindy explores the history of the movement, what it means to be a craft brewer, and how the word microbrewery was coined.
In the beginning of the craft beer revolution, people called us microbreweries. And actually, that term I learned in researching my book, that term was chosen by a young guy who was working for the American Homebrewers Association in Boulder, Colorado. And he was a computer geek, so he was into microprocessors. And he said, you know, these small breweries are kind of like microbreweries. And that's how that term came to be. The term craft beer developed more in the 90s when the brewers formed an association. And we were trying to figure out, how do we define the people we represent? And we coined the term craft brewers. Craft brewers are small, independent breweries dedicated to traditional practices and innovative practices in the brewing industry. We have sort of expanded the American palate for beer to a rainbow of styles that the big brewers had kind of ignored over the last 50, 60 years.
Well, gosh, it's incredibly thrilling to have this opportunity to talk to you because you're widely recognized as one of the very first pioneers. So take us back to how it all started in the 1960s and explain your place in it all.
You know, the real pioneer was Fritz Maytag, who lived in San Francisco and bought a failing brewery called the Anchor Brewing Company in 1965. And really, Fritz was alone in producing flavorful American beer. Then in 1976, you had the New Albion Brewery in Sonoma, California, started by a guy named Jack McAuliffe and a couple of women, Susie Stern and Jane Zimmerman. That was really the first real craft brewery, the first real microbrewery in America. That was a brewery cobbled out of, you know, Pepsi tanks and milk tanks, and it was kind of doomed to failure because it was too small, and nobody knew what craft beer was way back then. And then in the early 80s, you had Sierra Nevada, you had Red Hook, you had the Widmer brothers, and Brooklyn Brewery didn't start until 1988. I don't call myself a pioneer in the book. I feel that I'm part of what I call the first generation of craft brewers. The large brewers, I think, thought we were a fad and were going to go away. But obviously we have not gone away, and now there are more than 2,800 of us all across the country, and now those giant brewers are trying to create brands that compete in our category. So they've, I think, come around to accepting us. But actually, in the back of the book, in the appendix, I do a chronology of big brewer efforts to compete in the craft segment. And it really started in the 80s. I mean, they have introduced dozens, probably hundreds of beers trying to compete with us, but they never really stuck with them. You know, they came and they went. Only in the last couple of years have they begun to focus and promote, you know, beers like Blue Moon and Shock Top, Blue Moon being owned by Miller Coors, Shock Top by AB InBev. And now they're really playing hard in our segment. But I believe it's a real dilemma for them, because the more they promote flavor in beer, the more they undercut their huge brands, you know, the light beers and the light lager beers that they make. So I think it's a double-edged sword for the big guys.
That is such an interesting point of view. So there wasn't ever any, like, dirty backroom deals. They didn't try to rub any of you guys out, huh?
Well, I tell you, they are tough competitors. I remember the first time I took down a Budweiser tap, and it was at a place called Loudermilk's in Brooklyn, which is a club on a residential street. It was really kind of a strange place. And I came back to the brewery with that tap, and I was parading around. I still have the tap in my office, parading around saying, "Look at this, my first Budweiser tap." Well, they came down on me like a ton of bricks. I went back into that bar a few days later, and my tap was gone. And the owner, George Loudermilk, told me, "Yep, they made me a pretty good deal. You're out." So I learned a lesson there. Don't gloat.
Now, from your point of view, you described yourself previously as being the first generation of craft brewers. Tell us about how things have changed, and who are the ensuing generations?
Well, if you think about the brewers who started in the 80s, that's what I call the first generation. And for us, craft brewing was about the German purity law, the Reinheitsgebot, you know, only using grain and hops and water and yeast in the beer. The point of difference between us and the big guys was that we were making all malt beers, and we were adhering to this German purity law. You might think of us as kind of the baby boomer generation. Then in the 90s, breweries opened that were dedicated to Belgian-style beers, like New Belgium Brewery in Fort Collins, Colorado, started by Kim Jordan and her husband, Jeff Lebish. They were focused on making Belgian-style beers exclusively. Those beers don't necessarily abide by the German purity law. They have fruit beers. They have beers with different grains in them and different yeast. And it's a very different style of brewing. There were other seminal breweries in that second generation. Maybe you'd call them the Gen Xers, like Rob Todd with Allagash Brewery in Maine, Vinny Chilurzo with Russian River Brewery in California. And these were people who were really pushing the envelope, making sour beers, making beers that are aged in wine barrels or whiskey barrels, a whole flowering of exploration and innovation happened in the 90s. And the amazing thing is that the European countries that inspired us, like the UK and Germany and Belgium, they are now copying the beers that we're making here in America. So it's really come full circle.
There are a lot of people who may not be familiar with the names, the words, much less the roles that Nano and Gypsy breweries are playing in the industry now. Talk to us about the Nano breweries and the Gypsy breweries.
You know, the last chapter of my book explores what I call the third generation. These are kind of like the millennials of the craft beer movement. And it's interesting. When I started Brooklyn Brewery, my goal was to become a big brewery. I mean, I wanted to sell some beer. a lot of the new people starting up have less ambitious goals, and they're really focused on building a lifestyle for themselves. So there are quite a few people who don't even have breweries. They contract with other breweries to make beers for them, and you know, they're more involved with marketing the beer. And many of them are very focused on a local audience. They kind of like the role that a brewer can play in a community, and they're satisfied with staying small, which I think is a beautiful thing. I think if you look at the future, there are going to be many different models of craft brewery that are going to be successful. There are going to be national brands. There are going to be international craft breweries. You know, Brooklyn Brewery sells a lot of beer around the world. We just opened a brewery in Stockholm, Sweden last week. And there are going to be local breweries. There are going to be breweries like New Glarus in Wisconsin. They only sell in their home state. There are many niches here. This is not like the old days where the mainly German brewers were all making the same kind of beer. There's just an incredible flowering of beer culture in America.
Beer, from the point of view of your average American, really started off as being sort of the blue-collar drink. So how have you watched the beer drinkers change?
Well, I think beer is still the blue-collar drink. I mean, you can't compare craft beer to wine, for instance. To have a great wine cellar, you got to be a very rich person. But you can have the best beers in the world in your house at a reasonable price. Beer is still beer, you know? It's just that I think people are savoring beer and thinking more about what's in their beer and who's behind their beer today. And I think that partly explains why the decline in consumption, but the rise of craft beer, which I think is a good thing for America.
I do too. I completely agree. I'd like to know, from your point of view, how you see our Louisiana beer culture growing.
Well, you know, Louisiana, to be honest, is a little bit behind the rest of the country. And I really would blame that on the kind of restrictive laws you have in this state. Louisiana's food culture is unparalleled. And the idea that there are restrictions on the beer culture is just, it's not right. I think there are only about a dozen breweries in the state now. In New York, we have about 140, and California has hundreds. Texas has many. So the laws here really restrict small brewers' ability to distribute their own beer and to get started in business. They restrict their ability to have a pub connected to their brewery and sell their beer to the public. And these are all laws that go back to the days after Prohibition. They're really archaic laws. And in a lot of states, those laws have been changed by craft brewers. I think the politicians are going to recognize that this is holding back the state, that craft brewers are good for the economy, and they're good for local culture. And I'm confident they're going to change here in Louisiana.
Steve Hindy, co-founder and president of Brooklyn Brewery and author of The Craft Beer Revolution.
Well, now here's my story, my claim to glory. Somebody get a pencil and write it down for me. Born on a mountain, raised in a cave. Beer and boogie is all I crave. Drinking and stinking, riding and running.
When we come back from a short break, we'll visit Nola Brewing Company, where enjoying one of their delicious beers can benefit the Roots of Music project. Stay tuned.
I got rhythm all in my shoe. Soul from the south and the blue. Well, come on, baby, come along with me.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
Come on, baby, come along with me. Get your little taste of soul.
Kirk Coco started the Nola Brewing Company after Hurricane Katrina, which stands as a personal symbol of recovery and rebirth for him. like anyone who went through the storm. He understands how vulnerable our culture is and staked his claim as part of it. The brewery's been in operation and recently launched its first pale ale in collaboration with the Roots of Music program. Producer Thomas Walsh went to the brewery for the beer's launch party and sent us this postcard.
When I was sitting on the board of Roots of Music, we were trying to come up with good ideas that could bring additional money in. And I just kind of threw out there, it'd be great, we could do like a charity beer. And I thought they'd shoot it down, you know, but they were like, no, that sounds good. And then Derek Tabb, who's the drummer for Rebirth, he goes, well, what would we call it? And I said, well, Roots of Music's a really long name for a beer. I said, Derek, why don't you just give me your band's name, you know, because he plays with the Rebirth Brass Band. He goes, you want to use Rebirth? You could use Rebirth. And I said, are you serious? And he said, yeah, I'd love it. He goes, let me talk to the band, but I bet they'd love to have a beer named after him. And lo and behold, a few months later, we were working on a tap handle for Rebirth Pale Ale. Part of this is to continue the musical culture that exists in our city. This culture came early on with young kids playing instruments out on Bourbon Street and in the French Quarter on the street from a very young age, like 8, 9, 10 in the old days. Well, we started to lose that because now you do stay in school till you're 18. So when you pick up an instrument at 18, it's a lot different than when you pick up an instrument at 4 or 5 or 8. So what we're trying to do is rebuild that inherent knowledge that our city had. So what we're doing in the Roots of Music is trying to continue that cultural heritage and train these kids on the music of our history, and then also giving them something to actually do after school so that they're kept busy and learning something useful. And now the goal is just to get more money so that we can do a better job and reach more kids. The beer itself, you know, has a wonderful centennial hop aroma to it. And just a good malt base, so it's not going to be so hoppy that people get scared away from it. So I think it's going to do well. I think it's an easy beer for people who want to support Roots of Music to pick up and have a drink or two or four when they're eating crawfish or out tubing this summer or watching live music wherever they are. I'm Kurt Coco, the president of NOLA Brewing Company. And we've been talking about our Rebirth Pale Ale, a fundraising beer for the Roots of Music Foundation today.
Although Louisiana has always been known for its great food, compared with the rest of the U.S., our craft beer scene has lagged behind. Brooklyn Brewery founder Steve Hindy believes Louisiana's restrictive laws are largely to blame. But over the last 5 years, that hasn't stopped independent breweries from forging ahead. From Parish Brewing Company in Lafayette to newer ventures like Gnarly Barley Brewing Company in Hammond, we're about to catch up. Baton Rouge's Tin Roof Brewing Company is in its third year, but it experienced more than a few hiccups before it found its way. Co-founder William McGee explains how he handles the trials and triumphs of owning a microbrewery.
At the end of a good day, you can celebrate by drinking a beer, and at the end of a bad day, you can blow steam off by drinking a beer. And it certainly helps when it's something that you've made and you created. It kind of reminds you of what you're doing and why you're doing it. This business is like a roller coaster that, you know, one second you'll hear that you got this new account that's selling 20 kegs a week, and then the next second your glycol chiller goes out and, you know, all the beer spent overnight at 10 degrees higher than it should have been, and you can't package today. I mean, it's something every day. I think for me, and I guess I can say for Charles too, having a partner, a business partner, has been really great, because I feel like we can vent and just get all that out between each other, and then it kind of makes it all go away, and then it's okay, we did that, now what are we gonna do to fix it? We've had several hiccups along the way. I think we rushed to get some beer out in the very beginning that maybe if we had it to do over again, we would have waited a little bit longer and you know, it's hard going from doing 10-gallon test batches to 1,000-gallon batches. It wasn't quite the same extrapolation of the recipe, so I wish we would have taken a little more time there. That was probably the biggest mistake we've made, but I think it was humbling, and we learned a whole lot from that, and, you know, without that, we might not be where we are today.
When did you feel like you were really on the right track? Was there an addition that you made to the team that you were like, okay, now we can do it?
I guess the main reason we know we're on the right track is because we're still in business. That was always a primary goal of ours. They say hindsight is 20/20 for a reason, and there are lots of things that, you know, I wish we could change. But I will say, I think every wrong thing we've done, we've learned from it. And I think as long as we're not repeating those mistakes, then that's what kind of keeps us on the right track. Bringing Tom Dagerpont, our brewmaster, on has been a fantastic move. Tom makes great beers, and I guess our fans and even people who don't necessarily like a lot of our beers do tell us all the time that one thing they appreciate from Tin Roof Brewing Company is the consistency of our beers, which I think is a problem that a lot of microbrewers have, is that, you know, batch to batch varies. And, you know, on one level, that's part of being a small brewer, but on the same level, you know, your customer expects Tin Roof Blonde to taste like Tin Roof Blonde. And so I think Tom has been great at that, and that is definitely one of the better moves we've made.
Now, you talk about growing wider, you know, and broader within the state and keeping it local. Do your plans extend beyond the state's borders at all? And when will it be time to stop growing?
Yeah, it's funny, in our business plan, people always ask us about the business plan and, you know, what our 5 and 10 year goals are. And it's just, in this industry, I feel like it's so broad that and so speculative that you really, I mean, we have ideas of where we want to be in 5 and 10 years and all that. But I mean, if we could stay in Louisiana and Mississippi and reach our volume goals, then, I mean, we have no reason to ever get outside of there. So I think in the long term, we'd love to be a southeastern regional brewery. And, you know, we'd love to get into Texas at some point and kind of get into Georgia and, you know, Florida. But as far as, it's not necessary. If we're reaching our goals of volume and keeping our customers happy and we're happy here, then, you know, it's not something that just has to happen.
I'd like to know, William, how do you feel about Budweiser and Coors on Tap? The big dudes, you know, that you're going up against, where you're having to replace, maybe sometimes oust them out of a spot in the taps.
I will say it's very interesting how the craft beer scene as a whole is changing. When we first started, I mean, even only 3.5 years ago, it was like a lot of those were untouchable, that each bar was going to have this many domestic taps, and then the craft guys were fighting over 2 to 3 taps. But as it's growing, you're either seeing bars adding taps so that they can accommodate all the new crafts, or you're seeing a lot of those domestic taps being lost because there's just such a variety now between all the Louisiana breweries and then all the bigger breweries that are expanding and coming into our state. When we first started, it was kind of taboo to even think about going after one of the big guys' taps, and now it's kind of a more commonplace thing where, you know, not necessarily saying that's what craft guys are trying to do, but I guess from the retailer side, you're seeing a lot of bar owners saying, well, you know, I've got these in bottles and, you know, I'd rather have a craft guy on tap. So it's interesting watching the industry change a little bit and seeing if that's going to keep going in that direction, or if the big guys fight back and kind of say, hey, we're not okay with this. You know, you craft guys can have this market share and that's it. So it's interesting to see where it's going.
Well, in all of this, have you ever seen or felt like the whole beer thing was just being taken too seriously?
Yes. I think a lot of people lose sight of the fact that this is fun and it's about being artistic and creative. And, you know, we go to festivals all the time and sample our beers to people, and I usually try and keep with the idea of, if you like one of the five beers that we're offering, then I'm happy. If you hate the other four, that's okay. That's your personal preference. And I think that a lot of people maybe get a little too serious about hating beers and hating the taste. You know, it's, I guess when you're on this side of it and you have a brand and you have your children, our beers, our children are out there and people are talking about how they hate them. You know, it's kind of like, look, you don't have to hate it. Yeah, just you can tell me that it's not to your personal preference, and that's fine. There's lots of articles that go around in the craft beer industry now about how, you know, are we coming too much like wine snobs as far as tasting and judging every little bit of every beer. And so, you know, and that's, if that's what people want to do, that's fine. That's why we have so many different craft beers. I guess I've kind of always been more of, I either like a beer or I don't. And the ones I like, I'm going to enjoy. I like to keep it simple.
William McGee, co-founder of Tin Roof Brewing Company in Baton Rouge.
Drink a beer. Well, in the evening, drink a beer. Well, in the afternoon, drink a beer. Yes, in the morning, drink a beer. Yeah, in the spring, drink a beer. Wine is fine, but give me lots of beer.
Roof's William McGee isn't the only one who thinks some people take their devotion to craft beer maybe a little too seriously. Native New Orleanian and food writer Scott Gold gives us his take on the recent upsurge of microbrew aficionados and a defense of mass-produced domestic drafts.
The rise in craft breweries and beer connoisseurship in the United States over recent years has come with it a new breed of personality, the beer snob. Also known as the beer geek or beer nerd, they have much in common with the discerning enophiles that are a familiar stereotype of the food and beverage world. Only these folks tend to favor beards and bellies over bespoke suits and goblets. Not that I'm knocking them. They clearly adore beer, and so do I. I'm the same way when it comes to oysters, crawfish, and the perfect dark roux. That said, hearing them discuss beer with one another often sounds like an exotic foreign cipher to which I have no codex, or the recounting of details from a George R.R. Martin or Frank Herbert novel. Dude, have you tried the Defenestrator Schwarzwalder Kirschtort Doppelbock, they might ask. It's made with Andalusian nightshade hops from Burkina Faso that only bloom every 6 years in the light of a full sturgeon moon. Good stuff. Yeah, another might reply, it's good, but the back end has kind of an amorous marmoset note that throws off the hops for me. But I'm really loving what's coming out of the Surly Mongrel Brewery right now. Their barrel-aged Widowmaker Durian Lambic is fantastic, but it's got a 96% ABV, so you really have to watch yourself. Oh, and have you tried their septuple smoked Flanders Oat Bruin? I'm told their pearl barley is hand-sorted by Alsatian eunuchs. Okay, so picking fun of beer geeks might be low-hanging fruit, but that's the way it happens these days. As with music, to many, the world of beer seems to become cooler and more interesting the more obscure and ridiculous it gets. While I love craft beer and the lovely people who make it, I'm going to tread out on a limb here and also disclose the fact that I love inexpensive, mass-produced American beer as well. You might not think that a cold brewski needs any sort of apologia these days, what with this being America and all, but I'm increasingly finding myself in the position of defending my choice to order what certain people consider domestic swill. Their upturned noses and cluck tongues beg me to stick up for my fondness for the cheap stuff, and I'll do so here. Part of my affection for inexpensive domestics certainly has something to do with the fact that the beer companies had me all but brainwashed with their marketing from an early age. Well before I was even able to enjoy their products legally, I knew that beer was supposed to be a whole lot of fun, whether it was hanging out with voluptuous Miller Lite girls in bikinis or pulling pranks with Spuds McKenzie the party dog. By the time I came of age, I was all but hooked on the notion that beer equals hearty partying, and who doesn't want to have a good time? Beer nostalgia also extends to my family. Until the day she passed, my grandmother would always order a frozen fishbowl mug of Budweiser at Herbie K's restaurant in Shreveport, home of the Shrimp Buster. I always delighted in the fact that Grandma, who I knew more as a cottage cheese and grapefruit kind of person, never failed to pair her fried seafood and thick-cut onion rings with a frosty brew. And I think of her fondly when I do the same, whether it's back at Herbie K's or at Domalisi's Po' Boy Shop uptown, where you can still get a frozen fishbowl goblet of Miller High Life, the champagne of beers, for under $3. I'll be a sucker for that every time. Like my grandmother and her seafood, there's simply a time for inexpensive domestic beer. Sometimes, instead of a dark double chocolate oatmeal raisin stout with a head as thick as a milkshake, you just want a cold oat soda, especially because it's so hot here in Louisiana during the summer. I once had to explain to a friend in London that drinking cheap American lagers here is our way of hydrating, because beer is somewhat less dubious than our public drinking water, and also more fun. After a long day in the hot, muggy July soup, a can of cold Coors is often preferable to an ale flavored with ancient gruits, bog myrtle, and reindeer lichen. So, to those who turn up their noses and scoff at the very idea that mass-produced American beer even exists, I say that, as the proverb goes, to everything there is a season, and a time for every purpose, and every beer under heaven.
Scott Gold is a food writer in New Orleans. His Food Porn Fridays column is available each week through nolavie.com. How can beer transform some of your favorite recipes? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Market. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How can beer transform some of your favorite recipes? You'll be amazed. Beer contains hops and malt that subtly impart an element of sweetness, perfect for cooking pork and chicken. In fact, I'll often substitute a light beer for chicken stock in a recipe. The beer deepens and enriches the dish, and trust me, you'll never know there was a beer in there. The yeast in beer is also thought to make baked goods lighter. It's almost shocking how light a beer can make a heavy cheesecake or chocolate cake. These days, beer can be found in salad dressings, bread, and even caramel candy. I have to confess, one of my favorite desserts involves a scoop of chocolate or vanilla ice cream with a Guinness poured on top. Give it a try. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. In 2008, multinational beverage company InBev bought Anheuser-Busch and started letting some of its employees go. It didn't matter that a lot of those workers had been loyal to the company for years. The shift came from the top down, and a lot of great people got lost in the shuffle. But some of that surplus of talent became a great asset in the craft beer industry. Here's Mary Wiles, technical director of Brooklyn Brewery.
Anheuser-Busch had probably the best technical center in the world for brewers. Lots of PhDs, people whose specialty might be just what are the alpha acids doing in a particular hop. And those people have now been released to become consultants or work for smaller brewers. And it allows smaller brewers to take advantage of this knowledge that was acquired through years and years of experience and experimentation. And what it does is give you, the person who's running the craft brewery now, the ability to reproduce and really look at what is happening in my beer. Why are these flavor characteristics coming out? What is it I'm really looking for? And as much as it sounds like a factory or a laboratory experiment, if you can analyze your beer with gas chromatography, you can see those fermentation products and how they develop, and you can control them. And I think craft brewers have gained a tremendous amount of knowledge by having those individuals available to them. People that I worked with in AB are now consultants all over the U.S.
But those aren't the only shifts Mary's seen take place during her 30-year career in the beer industry. The workplace had a completely different atmosphere in the 1970s, practically unrecognizable when compared to the passionate and benevolent place it's become.
I have seen people move from the brewing industry being very, very closed with mostly German men who brought a lot of knowledge from the old country with them to groups of people simply interested in making fabulous beer. So it is a very diverse population. And the more diversity you bring to it, the more interesting it becomes. So there are men and women and people of color from all parts of the world who have information that they want to bring. And I've seen that change over the years and work with just everyone and anyone.
As a woman, was it hard to get into the field, particularly going to work for one of the beer giants? How did that transpire?
Well, the first thing was, and I am one of the products of those first equal employment opportunity laws. So brewers, along with many other industries, needed to look for diversity. And so I had my first interviews and people said, well, you know, your background looks really good and we like the way you're describing what you'd like to do. And the government says we need more women. So I thought, well, I'm not sure if I'm embarrassed. I'm not sure if I'm insulted, but I would like to do this job. So it went from there. It was being in the right place at the right time, but also having the background that would allow me to perform. And I had some great experiences and some kind of, oh, you could probably compare them to hazing. One time I was inspecting the bottom of a tank. We thought we had some spider cracks in it. And I went inside with my flashlight and they shut the door. And I started knocking on the side of the tank saying, okay, guys, I'm in here. And there was laughter outside. And the next thing I knew, water started coming in right from the bottom. And just slowly, this was a very large tank. So it would take forever to completely fill me up with water. But I thought, I'm a great swimmer, but that's not going to help me in a little while. And shortly, very shortly, they opened the door and everybody ran away. So I thought, well, I could report this. I could really say, I need these guys to be disciplined. And perhaps I'd never be able to work in the brewery again. So we chalked it up to this is experience, and some of those people have become my greatest, greatest friends in the industry. So a little bit of initiation, that's what got me there.
What is it that you think the big domestic breweries are doing that craft beer might be able to learn from them still?
That's a great question. I'd say it's consistency. One needs to look at your raw materials very, very carefully. You want to make sure that you're getting what you want when you buy malted barley. You want to make sure that the hops that you contract for actually have those characteristics that you're interested in. And then as you start the brewing process, big brewers have phenomenal control systems so that their mashing cycles always occur at the same temperature and for the same amount of time. Their straining abilities are just top of the line. And therefore, they've controlled a consistent process so that when you introduce the yeast, you can almost predict what's going to happen because you have taken care of all of your inputs and you understand what's going on. And that's what made Budweiser taste the same all over the country, is the ingredients that went into it were top quality and highly controlled, and the systems that move beer along through the brewery were also of the highest quality. I think that helps craft brewers understand how to make their product over and over again and make it be the product that their drinkers are counting on.
Mary Wiles, Brooklyn Brewery's technical director and former employee of Anheuser-Busch.
Thank you.
recently, beer has become a new mixing element in cocktails, inspired by the proliferation of craft beer flavors. Beer adds many elements to the mixologist's bag. Usually, the flavor combines bitter with sweet. It's relatively low in alcohol and brings on the bubbles, too. Across the country, people are mixing up standards like Pimm's Cups, Bloody Marys, Mimosas, and Sangria using beer as the base. Hurricane season officially starts in June, but hurricanes are always in season in Louisiana. The original hurricane cocktail was invented at Pat O'Brien's Bar in New Orleans' French Quarter. During World War II, European scotch was very difficult to import, but rum from the Caribbean was readily available. Liquor salesmen forced bar owners to buy up to 50 cases of rum just to obtain a single case of fine scotch. Pat O'Brien's bartenders came up with a pleasing solution to the rum surplus by combining it with sweet fruit juices and serving it in a glass that resembled a hurricane lamp. Thus, the original hurricane was born. Carlos Knott of Bayou Teche Brewery mixes up a particularly interesting version of the hurricane, transforming it into a beer cocktail. He makes it by the punch bowl, combining pineapple juice, orange juice, grenadine, fresh citrus juices, and generous amounts of spiced rum and Grand Marnier. Then he lightens the mix with a couple of bottles of his L.A. 31 Passionnée beer. The presentation is completed with maraschino cherries and fresh slices of orange and lemon. He calls his version the Passionnée Hurricane. Trust me, it's just the thing to mix up when a storm is brewing in the Gulf and you feel a hurricane party coming on. For a copy of Carlos's recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and there is no better way to get a Louisiana party started than with a Passionnée Hurricane from Bayou Teche Brewing. Watts has been essential to the growth of craft beer in Louisiana. She inherited the Avenue Pub in New Orleans from her father and decided to change its profile from a purveyor of the standard champagne of beers to craft beer that actually tastes like champagne. And while Louisiana is becoming increasingly populated with craft beer emporiums like the Avenue Pub, Polly will be the first to tell you our beer scene's got a long way to go. Here's how she thinks we can do it.
What beer has, in the same way that food has its own websites, right? Beer has its own websites, and those websites have reviews on them. So when you're a beer bar, you get written up on Beer Advocate and Rate Beer, and then there's Draft Magazine. And people who really follow beer follow all those sources. So we get a lot of what we call beer tourists, which is people who have either chosen New Orleans for the beer selection or who know they're coming to New Orleans for the many other reasons you would come to New Orleans. And every place they go, they look up those beer sites, and that's where they find us. What I think is really, really exciting about where we're going, where the city is going, is that New Orleans is now on the map for food, mm-hmm. nationally and internationally. We are absolutely on the map for cocktails, nationally and internationally. Absolutely. I think in the next 5 years, we're going to be on the map for beer. And I think you're going to see people planning beer vacations, which they do now. A lot of people that love beer do this now. I think in the next 5 years, you're going to see people planning beer vacations in this city. Because what we've done, which is a little bit different than the evolution that you see in other communities, we have mixed those high-end, rare, nuanced, very elegant beers in to a lot of restaurants and bars in the city. Now, do they have 50 taps of them like I do? No. But you can go to Sylvain and get really elegant beers. August has Saison DuPont as well as Tilcangoose and other things. that is going to turn us into a beer destination. So in the next 5 years, I think you're going to see New Orleans explode. And that's fueled also by the number of local breweries that we have that are opening up tap rooms. So there's more options than just the pub. I mean, you can go to the pub, you can go to the Bulldog, you can go to NOLA Brewing. We've got this new micro brew pub opening in the Lower Garden District called Courtyard. So all those things, I think, are going to turn New Orleans into a place that people come for beer.
That hopeful sentiment is echoed by Tin Roof Brewing Company's William McGee, who's doing what he can to keep the industry moving forward at his Baton Rouge brewery.
Once we open our tap room, too, that's going to be a nice new medium for getting new beers out there to customers without having to go through the commercial process of getting tap space in a bar, getting shelf space in a grocery store. So that's going to be exciting because we'll be able to experiment and do fun things here and have people come here and do it so that we can brew up 15 gallons of something and put it on tap. And if it sells, then great. If not, you've got 15 gallons invested instead of a whole lot of money. I think the future of craft beer in Louisiana, it's only going to keep growing. As I grew up in Mississippi and then have lived in Louisiana for 12 years, so you know, I feel like we're always kind of behind the national trend of everything. But one good thing is we catch up, and obviously we're known here for culinary expertise, and I think that people are realizing that craft beer is kind of fits in that category. I think it's only a matter of time before Louisiana is known as being maybe not having the most per capita microbreweries, but having the most quality and different and wild recipes and great ingredients and quality beers.
Tin Roof Brewing Company's William McGee and the Avenue Pub's beer guru, Holly Watts.
I want one for the highway. I want two for the road.
Edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we visit with chef and restaurateur John Besh, who was just named the newest member of the James Beard Foundation's Who's Who of Food and Beverage in America.
Each essay that I write, most of the essays are blunders that I created in the kitchen. And I think through those blunders, I've learned my greatest lessons on cooking, period. Things like this kind of teach me a lot about food that I didn't just learn out of the textbooks and in the beautiful kitchens in upstate New York and, for that matter, the professional kitchens that I worked in.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakima Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.